Welcome to the Bearcats Blogcast. My name is Scott, joined, as always, by Matt Oper. How's it going today, Matt?
It is fantastic. I just had a day off. I slept for like a million hours. I am feeling refreshed.
Yes, days off during the week. Really can't beat them.
Yeah, unfortunately, because of my long naps, I did not do any research. So this podcast is going to be, well, what you'd expect.
It'll be like every other podcast.
About an hour in length and of dubious value.
But we do have some, for all the people who complain about how negative we've been talking about the Bearcats, a very positive performance Saturday against Tulsa. After a shaky first half, which I don't think many people would argue that it was a bit shaky, before you see kind of pulled away near the end, Bearcats put the hammer down and just throttled Tulsa, getting up nearly 30 points halfway through the second half before the bench guys got in and the starters came out. It's like, that's the game that we've been wanting to see for the last, you know, since the first Tulsa game. A game they haven't played, like, yet in February. And, like, this was their best effort, I think, by far since the Xavier game.
Yeah, I mean, it's been the most cohesive offensive effort for the Bearcats in, since the second half of that Xavier game. And for the last 2-3 weeks, the biggest issue with UC has been not the front court play. I mean, Kyle and Gary. They're going to give you quality minutes and good performances almost every night out. If they don't, it's going to be an off night, which happens. But, you know, you can live with the off nights because they're so few and far between. But the perimeter play has been suboptimal for about a month. Jacob Evans, Trey Copain, Kevin Johnson, they've all been up and down. Kevin Johnson, shockingly, has been the most consistent of the three over the last 3 or so weeks. But it's always been one guy having a good game, not two guys having a good game for the duration. This game was an outlier because all three of those guys played very well. The offense looked crisp. There was a lot of ball movement, a lot of man movement, which has always been which is the key. I mean, it's been talked about so often with Mick's friendship with Mike Bray about how he's trying to institute motion offense principles with these Bearcats. And that's fine. And it's been to the benefit. I mean, this is by far the best offense of the Mick Cronin era. There's really no doubting that at this point. But there are times where they relapse into old, you know, the old style where everybody's standing around and watching the ball and they're just waiting for a post player to duck in so they can get good position and, you know, try to get a contested hook. That was the MO for so long that they tend to fall back into it. But when the ball's moving, when the guys are moving and the ball, you know, the ball's kind of fizzing around, this is an incredible offense to watch. It really is. The problem is it's not consistent enough against the good teams. You know, Tulsa's an okay team. They're not the best, but they're far from the worst in this league. But the last time out at Tulsa, they really kind of struggled with the Golden Hurricane, and they did for a half here. But in the second half, they were just a incredible offensive machine for about 10 minutes. You know, they score in the first 10 minutes of that half, they outscored them 26-8, and that kind of did the game.
At second half, Cincinnati goes 13-26 from the field, 3-8 from 3, 13-20 from the foul line. Tulsa, on the flip side, Tulsa scores 32 points the first half on 46% shooting. They hit 6 threes. Second half, they attempt 16 field goals, and 5 of their makes were threes. I'm pretty sure E2 was the only guy on Tulsa who scored like the last like 10 minutes. Just the perfect blend of a good defensive shutdown, especially in that opening segment of the second half. Even to close the first half, UC closed nice. They put the run together to get up 6. They just put the throttle down, and their talent is so much better than Tulsa's that, like, this is kind of what we expected at Tulsa, in a way. But, like, the fact that they broke Tulsa's defense, and then Like, as you mentioned, everybody involved, like Copain, 8 assist, like everybody has an assist who started. Jennifer had 3 off the bench. Even Tobler had an assist. Like, everybody got everybody else shots. And, like, after the early turnovers started, like, stopped, it was just a machine. Like, they played November offense in February, which is really great to see.
Which is great to see, and it's also an extreme rarity for UC. I mean, generally, these kind of offensive outputs don't really happen. The Memphis senior day in SK's senior year is the only comparable performance that I can think of late in the season where you get this kind of offensive explosion. That's the only one. It's been, and that was, what, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while since they've had a performance like this at home in league play. The most interesting thing about this game to me, it wasn't so much the outcome, because really, I mean, it's UC at home against a Midland Conference opponent. They're going to win.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10, unless something crazy happens, they're just going to run away with the game in the end. But that doesn't mean there's not stuff you can take away from this game. And the one thing that I'm going to take away from this performance is not so much the performance, it's the lineup rotations and variations that Mick Cronin showed up that I really think are going to be pivotal for this team going down the stretch. Because for years, the easiest way to challenge a UC team in the Cronin era has been to zone them. Because historically, there's not been a lot of shooting, the ball movement's not great, and because of that, it's very difficult to beat a zone unless Kashmir Wright just goes insane from three, like he did in the Garden. But those games are so few and far between that you can't bank on those. There's really been no kind of systematic way to approach that. But I think they might have found one with this group, because in the second half, Tulsa went to the zone early, just like they did in the first half. But UC had a nice counter to that, which was to run Justin Jennifer and Troy Copain and basically go 4 around 1 with Gary as the lone big. And against that 1-3-1 look, they murdered that. They got good looks whenever they wanted them. You know, that guy slashed into the bucket, wide open threes. It was a phenomenal, you know, brief performance from that lineup that doesn't play together all that often. And I think going forward, if a team wants to throw a 1-3-1 at UC, that's what they need to do. They need to downsize immediately. They can only play one big against those because it just frees up the spacing so much more and gives guys length to the basket. And, you know, the easiest way to beat a zone is to get dribble penetration and kick out. But that's very difficult to do when you have two bigs like Gary and Kyle, you know, demanding all the attention and space in the interior.
Yeah, a big reason Jennifer played so many minutes, he played 17 minutes, was because Jaron Cumberland was suspended because of a violation of curfew. Mick still hasn't said if he'll play against Memphis, but since all he did was violate curfew, you have to imagine he'll play against Memphis. But even if he doesn't, you do have the answer with Jennifer. Like, he didn't do, it's like box score doesn't wow you, but like his overall play and like how UC just moved the ball with him on the court was something that like gave credence to the people who was like, yeah, Jennifer really needs to play like double digit minutes a game. And I don't think it's a coincidence. His minutes have started to pick up as we've gotten closer to like the tournament, and where you have to throw out some of these weird looks because you have no idea who you're going to play.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And it's not just like UC has a lot of, with the way this roster is built, there's a lot of guys who do very similar things, like Trey Scott and Gary Clark. Very similar physically. They move similarly, similar athleticism. Skill set, obviously, Gary is much more advanced than Trey is. Like, even Gary as a freshman is much more advanced than Trey is as a redshirt freshman. Like, that's night and day. But, like, they're just kind of similar dudes. Same thing with Nasir Brooks and Kyle Washington. They occupy the same spot. They play a similar back-to-the-basket game. They are very deliberate with their post touches, and it takes them, you know, a couple dribbles to get a move up, but more often than not, that interior play is going to be pretty good. You can just kind of go down the roster with the same-for-same, like-for-like replacements, and then you get to Justin Jennifer. there's really nobody on this team who does what he does the way he does it. And, you know, we've been harping for this entire season about how once you get to March and it's one and done, you need to have more variability in your offense and more variability in your approach. Nobody does what Justin Jennifer does. So just getting him more minutes, getting him more acclimated to the speed of the game and the pace of play is just going to serve you better in March, because you're going to have to turn to him and to give you 10 minutes in a tournament game and have him not wilt under the pressure. And the other way you can do that is to get him reps. And for most of the conference season, he's kind of been, you know, this lonely guy on the bench who's been ignored, even though he has a distinct skill set that no one else possesses. And so often, you know, you see runs into games where everything bogs down and they're just crying out for a creative outlet. He's a creative outlet. He's a very creative player. He is adventurous on defense, and not in a good way. So he has a very, very short leash. But, I mean, for all the good he does on offense, I think you can kind of weather a few bad defensive possessions. I mean, like, there were a couple plays where he created looks out of nothing. Like, that generated a wide-open three for Jacob Evans, and then another one was a drop-off dunk for, I believe it was Trey Scott. And, like, nobody creates plays like that for other people on this team. You kind of need that skill.
Yeah, going back to South Florida, like, the first game against South Florida, he's put up 24 assists against only two turnovers in conference play. Both of them came in the Tulsa game. And one thing that's definitely been noticeable ever since, I guess the last 2 weeks, he's attempted 3 3-pointers. He hasn't attempted any of the last three games. He's been driving a lot more, which has really helped open things up, like you said. Even if he doesn't drive, like, he's at least a shooter where you have to go out and, like, kind of get on him. He's definitely going to put the ball up, and he's 38% for the season. So you have to respect his shot. And he's like a point guard, so he can drive in and make plays for other people, which is a big compliment. You really, like, don't have consistently from Evans. I mean, like, he has good assist numbers, but he's not really a point guard. And you don't have it all from Kevin Johnson. That's just not one of his strengths as a player.
Yeah, I mean, like, there have been times this year where UC has tried to use Jacob Evans as kind of a secondary ball handler, and it just hasn't worked. It just seems like that's not a skill that he has at this point in his career. That doesn't mean he can't develop it. It's just that right now, you watch him try to put the ball on the deck and get 2-3 dribbles to the hoop. Like, it doesn't happen. He gets a dribble or two and he gets cut off real quick. And, like, I think there's been an acknowledgement, like, that asking that of Jacob Evans isn't really getting the best out of Jacob Evans. He's far better hunting shots, you know, when somebody else is doing the driving and creating, than he is creating shots for others himself. Like, that's really no knock on him. I mean, he just has a distinct skill set, and what he is a lights out knockdown 3-point shooter.
It seems like he does his better passing after he catches the ball when somebody gets it to him on the wing.
Yeah, like, he's very good at catch and move. Like, he'll catch and pump fake, take a couple dribbles, and get a good pass from there. But if you just give him the ball ISO at the top of the key, you're not going to get a lot of that possession. And so because of that, there's kind of been an acknowledgement that that's not really something that he can do. So who's the other guy who can do that? It's really only Justin Jennifer. Jerron Cumberland is phenomenal on the break. Like, as a ball handler in the fast break, I really want him handling the ball more than I want anybody else, because he's going to put his head down and it's over. Like, he's getting to the rim. You're not really going to stop him. Nobody's taking that charge, you know? But in the half court, that's not really, he can't really get up. He can't get his momentum up quickly enough so that he becomes a, you know, a player who can get to the rim whenever he wants. Not yet. I think that's going to be coming next year, but right now it's just not where he's at. So, like, there's this obvious need for a secondary ball handler on this team. And like, that's been an ongoing theme since Farad Cobb went away. I mean, that's the reason Farad Cobb got so many minutes in the first place, is that he is a really good secondary ball handler. And that allows you to move Troy Copain off the ball, where he's a much better shooter off the catch rather than off the dribble. And, I mean, it just kind of makes everything flow a little bit better. And yeah, just having that extra creative outlet, it really means a lot for the offense, because without that, it really bogs down quickly.
Yeah, definitely. And like, nothing against Copain and Kevin Johnson, but they're much better spot up shooters than they are if they take a dribble. Like, having somebody where you can give the threat of driving, dropping to Kyle Washington, who we definitely should mention, he had another monster game, like 18 points, 7-9 shooting. That free throw's a little shaky still. But yeah, like, he's like, if you have to respect Kyle Washington, because you can't like just give him buckets. And then you kick out to Kevin Johnson, who is like on fire. He's over 40% in league play. Like, he got off to that really terrible start, which has kind of like tanked his shooting numbers all season. But like, man, he's just like been like a revelation in league play.
Yeah, and
all but 13 of his makes have been in league play, which is kind of crazy.
And there's a really simple reason for that, and that at this point as a senior, finally, Kevin Johnson knows exactly what he is and exactly what he does, and he does not deviate from that one cent. What was the last time he took a dribble? What was the last time he took two dribbles on a possession? It's been a while. He catches it, he passes, or he shoots. Like, he knows exactly what he's good at. He knows his spots, and if he gets the ball in those spots, off the right looks, the ball's going up. 9 times out of 10, it's going in. And he doesn't do anything more than that. The only time you see him take dribbles is when he gets a steal and it's a run out. Like, he doesn't dribble in half court anymore because, I mean, that's the biggest reason why his turnover rate was so appalling the last couple of years. But, like, he's staying within himself. He knows his lane. And because of that, he went from being a huge negative offensive player to just being an above average to borderline, you know, plus offensive player in conference play. And I, like, based off the way this season started, I did not see that coming. You know, I am on record for a long time as not being a Kevin Johnson fan. This version of Kevin Johnson, I love.
Yeah, cause like, he's, like you mentioned, like, does everything, like, in his lane. He's not trying to be, like, more than he is, which I think was kind of his problem before. He's trying to be, like, the superstar two guard instead of, like, the guy who's there to catch and shoot. I remember, like, his freshman season. Or might not have been. Probably was his sophomore season.
No, it was his freshman season.
When he was just, like, the guy, like, who came in late in the league play and was, like, the three-point shooter off the bench. Like, part of a big reason why that team, like, got hot down the stretch was because he was catching and shooting.
Yeah, he borderline won a game as a freshman against Rutgers on the road because of his shooting, on a day where Justin Jackson and Sean Kilpatrick were just, they were not there. Like, it was just a rough game from them from the start, and he kind of rescued that game to the point where they could take over in the end like they always did.
And that's really all he needs to do now, and he's doing a great job at it. And, like, his defense, his, like, defensive numbers. Like, I wish we had better defensive numbers for college. His impact is a lot better than, like, a steal and a half per game or whatever he's averaging. And, like, that's it.
Yeah, and I think, I honestly think he's playing better defense in conference play than he was in the non-conference. He just seems to be everywhere all the time. And that wasn't the case. I mean, like, obviously he had games where he locked people up in the non-conference, but he just seemed to be... He didn't seem to have as much impact in those games because he was not freelancing as much. I don't know if freelancing is the right word, but he just kind of picked his spots to, like, he kind of randomly double teams people now and will pick a back and get a layup that way. That seems to happen once a game for the last 4 or 5 games. He's getting into open court off those looks. I mean, like, it's just, he wasn't doing that earlier in the year. Like, there weren't a lot of Kevin Johnson one-on-nothing runouts because he just picked a dude's pocket at the center circle, but there's been a lot of those in the last couple of games.
Yeah, like, just the overall level of the defense in general. Like, you really can't complain about much. Except, I guess, if you wanted to complain about the SMU game, you'd have a point. But... let's focus on the positive, and look at the bigger picture. As we get closer to the AAC tournament, a lot of stuff has settled down. Cincinnati and SMU have already clinched the byes, and there's still 2 weeks to go in the regular season. The big jumble is in the middle. Houston 9-5, Connecticut 9-5, Memphis 8-6, coming into town for that big game on Thursday night. UCF 8-7 for another big game for UCF on Sunday afternoon. And then like the rest of the league is, it's like, who cares really?
Garbage.
Except maybe Temple is kind of an interesting team, depending on where they end up. Because they could probably upset whoever they play in the first round and give...
Well, yeah, they could upset whoever they play. They could also lose by 40 to UCF, and they'd be like, yep, totally. Totally. Makes sense.
Outside of SMU, and like that's the only team that they've been like just dominated by. Like, they could be a tricky team in conference play. Or not conference play, in the conference tournament if UC ends up on their side of the bracket. Since Temple always plays UC close for some reason. Besides that one game where UC didn't, like, didn't miss a shot.
Like 2 years ago. Let's run that offense. Let's run the don't miss a shot offense. I'm a big fan of that. Yeah, but I mean, like, the 3-6, like, there are... Like, there are so many permutations of how that could end up, because they're all either 8-6 or 7-5 in the league, I believe.
Yes.
But they're all, like, within one loss of each other in the column. And here's the thing, like, all these teams play each other down the stretch. Like, if you look at, if you go through those six teams and they're, check out their last four games, like, they're all going to be very similar. Like, here's UC. They have Memphis, UCF, Houston, Connecticut. That's every team on that part of the list. Same thing for SMU. I think SMU has three of the four. And they all play each other. Like, anything can happen with these four teams. And they could end up in any conceivable lineup. Like, it's kind of crazy. I can't see any of them falling out of this top six. But I guess mathematically it's possible. But if that happens, we all know that, oh yeah, that team that finished sixth is really not sixth. They're not that good. They just played all the bad teams early and got their wins when they could.
The most interesting team is probably UConn, who was under 500 before their current winning streak. After they blew out South Florida, they won close game at UCF, had a big comeback to beat Memphis, and got a buzzer beater to beat Temple. And now, like, they're looking at Houston, SMU at home, at East Carolina against Cincinnati. There's a chance, like, that game at UConn could determine if UC would play UConn in a potential, what, like, semifinal game. Which, I'm pretty sure nobody ever wants to see UConn in the AAC tournament ever again. So, let's hope.
Yeah, UC fans... UC fans more than anyone.
Yeah, Houston has a tricky schedule left. Obviously, the UConn game, they go to Memphis and Cincinnati before they play East Carolina. It's going to be kind of interesting. Like, none of these teams, I think, are really tournament teams, unless like maybe Houston got hot. They'd have the only chance to like, break in.
No, I think for all four of these teams, the only way they get to the tournament is if they steal the bid. Only way. Like, I just don't see a profile from any of these four schools worthy of that line. Now, if Temple hadn't fucked things up for like the last 2 months, they would. But because they decided to, shit, I don't know, just like have everybody die and play kind of terrible basketball, they're out. Like, there's just no way.
Yeah, you can't lose to East Carolina by double digits.
I mean, you could have just stopped it. You can't lose to East Carolina. Like, that would have been perfectly acceptable.
Also fair. East Carolina cut kind of a frisky team.
Which is kind of amazing because they are dead last. That's right, folks. They are even worse than South Florida at offense. But they beat Temple by double digits, so.
And somehow they have like almost a top 50 defense. Just kind of crazy. And their defense has like been like average in league play. They still almost have a top 50 defense. It's kind of how good like the defense in this league and the terrible offenses where you have.
Well, yeah, but that's like that's what we're talking about. Is it chicken or the egg? Are the defenses good because the offenses are fucking horrible, or are the offenses really bad because the defenses are really good? It's impossible to know. It's a Mobius strip of logic. I can't tell beginning from end. All I know is you look at efficiency, and the AAC as a league has climbed out of the barrel, bottom of the barrel, and is now 29th out of 32 leagues. So,
while still being the slowest and worst shooting league.
Go us. We're great.
But it's the number one league in terms of block shots.
That is known as the Taco Fall corollary.
And number four in assists to field goals made, which is kind of interesting. But I guess it just shows they are like five players who can get their own shot, and three of them play on SMU, and the other one plays
The larger point is it's not the assist part of the stat that matters. It's the field goals made part of the stat. Because they're not good at that. As a league, this is not a good shooting league. I think we've made that point.
So, like, looking ahead, who do you think UC would match up with the best in the conference tournament? Like, what do you think is their best draw would be? Do you think it would be ending up with Houston or Memphis or South Florida or, God forbid, UConn?
I think, obviously, you want South Florida because I'll take the free win. Thank you. But, like, South Florida aside, I think Houston. I just don't know how they're doing this. Like, they really gave SMU all they wanted. Because Damian Dotson didn't miss from three, Rob Gray somehow like pulled 25 points or 20 or whatever it was out of his ass without any reasoning. Like, it's just, I don't know how they're doing this. It doesn't make any sense. Galen Robinson, like the performances that they're getting out of their guys. I mean, these are all guys that we've watched for a couple of years, and it's just like, none of this makes sense. How did you become this good? Are you this good? I'm not really sure. But your numbers are good. I'm very confused.
That's how I feel about Rob Gray in general. Like, every time I watch him play, it's like, oh, is he actually, like, how is he good? But he's actually, like, really good and, like, by far their best player. And when he's not on the floor, they are so terrible.
Oh, yeah, his on-off numbers are ridiculous.
I gotta say, if like we voted, which we don't have votes, I think I would probably vote him for the player of the year in the league.
I mean, I see the vote, because he's done more to elevate his kind of shitty surrounding cast, but it's semi. It's just semi at this point. Like, there's just no way anybody else is going to win it.
That's true. I'm just trying to be different.
I mean, if you look at the KenPom All-Conference, the standings he has, I think Gray is second. I haven't looked at this in a couple days. But I think it's Semi, Rob, Lawson, Kyle, and another SMU player. I'm not sure which one.
See, just in the league, Semi is fourth in minutes, second in offensive rating, which counts even like the scrubs. 12th in effective field goal percentage, 7th in true shooting, 19th in offensive rebound percentage, and his shooting numbers are insane. Yeah, it's definitely him. I shouldn't have tried to be a contrarian.
It's just Semi. He's got it.
He's going to win unanimously, probably.
No, there's always an asshole. There's always one asshole. It's just like, oh, no, he's definitely not the best player. It's this guy who's the third best player on his team.
I think, like, the only problem is, like, for the Bearcats is, like, there's really, like, who do you vote for to be the player of the year? There's really no
choice.
Well, yeah,
I mean, Kyle is the nominee, like, he's fourth in KenPom, if my memory is correct. But
he's definitely going to be on the all-conference team.
Yeah, but is he, like, actually the best player on the Bearcats?
Is it, like, debatable, kind of?
That's exactly my point. I would argue no. Is he the most important player for the Bearcats? I would definitely argue no.
Just like Gary Clark's overall stat line doesn't jump out at you. Like, Copain's stat line isn't, like, amazing.
Except for assist-to-turnover ratio. Which is worldly.
And then it's like Jalen Adams, like his numbers are kind of insane, and he's not in the top five on KenPom. He'll probably definitely be on the first team all league.
Yeah, but Jalen Adams' offensive rating is average. Literally average.
But you could argue that's because he has to do so much for that team.
No, like totally. Like you can make the Russell Westbrook argument for him, for sure. It's like, look at all the shit he has to do. It's like, yeah, look at the turnovers. Look at all the bad shots.
He's just on 44% of their baskets. It's crazy. His assist rate, 43.6, which just tops in the league. Turnover rate, 21.4. That's
like a post player's turnover rate. I'm pretty sure Kyle has a lower turnover rate. And Kyle, as we all know, never passes out of a double. And thus turns the ball over pretty regularly.
That game at Stores, or wherever they play it to end the season, it's going to be really interesting. Just going to UConn, then staying there to probably going home, really, just to go back to Hartford for the conference tournament. And maybe playing that team again would be really interesting.
Yeah, Stahl, I'm looking up where that game is played.
It's in, it says Stores on the, whatever I'm looking at. Who knows?
Gamble? It's a Gamble? They haven't been back to Gamble since the SK winner. It's been a long time since they've actually played in Stores.
They probably won't actually play there.
No, they do. I mean, they have to announce these so far in advance. Yeah, that's where they're playing. That's awesome. Like, they should honestly play every game at Stores, but they don't because, you know, money. I get it. But Gamble's the better venue by far, and every UConn fan agrees with me.
Speaking of venues, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention how with 5th-3rd on ice, Cincinnati's going to be playing their games at the NKU Arena. Do you have any hot takes about this, or do you really not give a shit?
I don't care. It's not that hard to get to. It's a nice arena. It's far better than US Bank. I mean, the fourth point was kind of a correlator to the third point, but yeah, those are my points.
Yeah, US Bank, if like they wouldn't step up, like for like when UC and Xavier play there, like they're definitely not going to step up now. Like that place has been a dump for like 30 years.
Yeah, and they, like, this was really, playing it at NKU is a big middle finger to the Niederlander Group who runs US Bank, because they have not put money into that. Like, it's a, like, basically none of the Cincinnati teams have put any money into the professional teams have put any money into their venues since they got them. Like, Paul Brown Stadium, you go, they're still, like, tube TVs above the concession stands. Like, you can get a flat screen for $100. And if you buy 100 of them, you can probably get them for less. But they just can't be bothered. And the same thing with US Bank. Like, they didn't want to put any money into it, but they still wanted UC to become their primary tenant. And, you know, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't go forward with an official announcement. UC passes them over because what they wanted for rent was ridiculous. And then suddenly they come out with renderings and for a proposed renovation. It's like, you guys are just assholes. Like, there's a reason nobody ever comes here. There's a reason you guys didn't get the GOP convention. Your arena sucks because the people you have running your arena suck. Like, they just can't be bothered to put money into it. It's that simple.
Yeah, it's like pretty cut and dry. It's more on the same wave with that one. Like, I don't really care where UC plays. Like, obviously, you would want the bigger arena, which is, would be US Bank. Like, KU Arena is new, and people seem to like it, I guess.
Yeah, it's a decent venue for a school that size. Like, it's right off the highway. It's really not that hard to get there. Parking is plentiful. There are a lot of Bearcat fans who live in Northern Kentucky. There's really no downside to doing it there. And you probably get to transport your court over there if you want to. So, at least you'll have your court. Even though it won't match the colors of the arena, but that's fine.
That's a small price to pay for satisfaction.
And giving a middle finger to people who are assholes.
Which you should always do. Either metaphorically or actually do it.
I prefer doing it through actions rather than actually doing it. But you know, that requires the recipient of the middle finger to understand it as a middle finger. So it gets tricky. It can go wrong.
You don't want to do that to the wrong person.
Nah. No, you don't.
Speaking of middle fingers, I don't know, that was a terrible segue.
Oh, I can't wait to see where this is going. Where are we going, Scott? I can't wait to get there.
We're going to Brackettville, where UC is probably going to get locked out of a protected seed, which is still kind of garbage. Most of the national projections have them as a 5 seed. You'll see like one or two that have them as a 4. I'm just looking at the major ones. Like Jerry Palm, very high on UC. He says them as a 4. But most other people, like, for the reasons the selection committee said, like, if they're going so high on quality wins, Cincinnati only has 3 top 50 RPI wins. And that's probably not going to get it done for a protected seed. Especially since the committee doesn't really give a shit about Sunday conference tournaments, as we saw last year.
And they don't. They don't care at all.
So if, like, you end up with SMU in the final, you just have to hope they already gave you credit for that.
Yeah. And I'm looking at our favorite site. I'm going to go ahead and say that this is your favorite site, Scott. So this is going to be news to you. But Bracket Matrix has the average seed of the Bearcats at exactly 5.0. So, yeah. The only way that really changes is if one of these teams above them just suddenly goes on a massive, irreversible slide. And, hey, Virginia's lost 4 in a row. So that's possible. And they have to win the tournament. And they have to beat SMU. And, like, they have to win the tournament slash it has to be SMU in the final. That's the only way they're going to get that quality win bump that they need to get into a protected seed. Like, if that doesn't happen, if they just win the conference tournament and they end up playing, I don't know, Houston in the final, then they'll probably still be a 5 seed.
Yeah. It's just looking at it, like, logically. Like, Villanova, Gonzaga, Kansas, North Carolina, Baylor, Louisville, Oregon, Arizona. Even, like, go down Duke, Kentucky, Florida, even Florida State. Like, all those teams, like, even if they lost their last 4 games or just continue to have losing streaks, they're probably all still going to be protected, and they're all the top 3 seeds. And yeah. You need UCLA, West Virginia. It's kind of a weird team, but has, like, a ton of quality wins. Purdue, who's, I think, leads the Big Ten right now. And Butler is currently a 4 seed, and who knows if Butler's actually good.
Yeah, I mean, the only teams above them that I can see dropping below them are conceivably Virginia, which, as discussed before, 4-game losing streak, not playing the greatest basketball in the world right now, and they kind of look like a dumpster fire. West Virginia, weird profile. They go on strange ups and downs. They can they can win five in a row and lose five in a row, seemingly. Like, there's not five games left to play, but you know what I'm saying. And Butler. Like, those are the only teams I can see going on a prolonged skid that would kind of dump them below UC. Other than that, like, there's just not a way for that to happen. And they could conceivably be leapfrogged by Wisconsin, maybe Notre Dame, and possibly SMU, but that's kind of a long shot.
Yeah, I guess it wouldn't count out, like, a Creighton if they finished hot and they did damage in the Big East tournament, because they're also a 5 seed. But, yeah, Wisconsin or Purdue, it kind of doesn't matter which one it is, because whoever wins the Big Ten, at least the I kind of think whoever wins the Big Ten regular season is getting a protected seed, just from what we've seen from history. I know none of them were a couple weeks ago, or whenever the hell that thing was. That's definitely going to change. Like, SMU is in the same boat as UC, where their profile just doesn't look, like, that great. And UC's kind of... Nick needs Iowa State to win a lot. Because if Iowa State drops out of the RPI Top 50, you only have 2 RPI Top 50 wins. And that kind of looks bad.
Yeah, and I haven't looked at this in a couple of weeks, but I'm pretty sure... I'm not pretty sure, but I think Iowa State has a relatively easy road in. Now, obviously, I'm saying relatively easy road in the Big 12, so that comes with a huge caveat, because the Big 12 is, what, the second best power conference right now?
See, they play Baylor, Oklahoma State at West Virginia.
Ah, fuck, I forgot the West Virginia game. So it's not easy at all, so they can probably lose all 3 of those. Fantastic.
That's kind of it's like, yeah, you have to root for some of these teams just for like that, like how UC has a root for UConn to win to get the 1 seed in case of a tie. Because I think the tiebreaker is between Memphis and UConn. And since UC only plays Memphis once, they have to have UConn do better. At least that's what somebody said on Twitter, and I'm choosing to believe them wholeheartedly.
What could possibly go wrong from that?
Nothing.
Hey, this Twitter egg says something I really want to believe. Yes, I'm going to believe that. That's fantastic. Yeah, we've all done it. We've all done it. Usually late at night, trying to go to bed, but looking at Twitter instead. Speaking for myself, I'm not going to guess what everybody else is doing at home. But that's like Monday through Friday night for me.
So let's look at some of these teams that UC would play real quick. Lunardi has them playing a play-in game winner, which we won't get into because who cares about that part. Has them in Purdue's region in Milwaukee. It's a kind of a neutral site game. Palm has them playing... It's a protected seed, but in Buffalo. So that's really nothing either. Like in West Virginia's region, which would be interesting for reasons I don't know. I'm sure somebody could tell us.
Nah, I'm like... Some of our wealthiest donors could tell us all about it.
Stuart Mandela Fox has UC Purdue in Milwaukee as well. And... SB Nation has the worst one, which is UC as a 5 seed going to UCLA at Sacramento, which would be the worst. And let's hope that doesn't actually happen.
That would be, yeah, the worst. Hey, but you get to play at Boogie moved. Shit.
It seems like the biggest problem, if UC does like end up with a top 4 seed, is that they're just going to get slated in, like, Milwaukee, it appears.
Yeah. I mean, like, if UC... Okay, so if UC gets a 4 seed, they're obviously going to be the lowest ranked of the 4 seeds, so that means they get the number 1 overall seed. Yay! That's not ideal.
Because region-wise, like, the way they do it, they matched it up was by region. And if Louisville and Kentucky are... protected seeds, which they're going to be. They'll both be in Indianapolis, so there goes your closest trip home.
Yeah, I mean, like, they're going to have to get on the road. There's not, wherever they play, there's not going to be a huge UC contingent. Let's just put it that way.
Like, then you just have to hope you, like, you don't get shipped off to, like, Tulsa or... I don't even know where you would go. It's, like, pretty much Milwaukee. Like,
Spokane? I heard that went well once. Oh, I just got it from a non-existent producer. That did not go well last time.
that was a problem.
Not that it's Spokane's fault, but I don't like Spokane anymore.
Shooting for the stars. If you see as a 4 or 5 seed, what would be the Sweet 16 one seed you would want to see them up against? We'll just go with the 4 right now.
I was going to say, is it current or what I think is going to happen?
Just roll with Villanova, Gonzaga, Kansas.
I mean, it's got to be Gonzaga, right?
I think so.
Just like I think this is the best team of this era for them. But they played St. Mary's twice. Like they've had exactly 2 games in the last, what it would be 3.5 months at that point. I think that's the way you go. And they could just be awesome and slaughter us. But you know, that's a team you want. You don't want a team that's proven and battle tested and has been through the wars, and because they play a ridiculous conference slate with a lot of really, really good teams. And that's not Gonzaga. St. Mary's is good, but they really haven't played anybody for months.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. Like, obviously, you don't want to, like, the undefeated number one team on KenPom. It's not the one you'd want to jump out of your seat to play. But for, like, the same reason, like, the last, like, KenPom team, like, in the top 50 they played was, that wasn't St. Mary's, was Tennessee. Back in December, and that was
a while.
That was Tennessee. Like, they have a bunch of good wins, like Iowa State, Florida, Arizona.
No, like their profile is amazing.
All of those were December 3rd, and
that was the point. they play all those teams before anybody paid attention to college basketball, except for, you know, Kentucky fans. And this year, UC fans, because our football team sucked and we all just wanted a blessed escape from the unrelenting death spiral of Tuberville.
And they have the early conference tournament disadvantage.
I forgot. Yeah, because they play a week early, right?
Yeah, their conference tournament ends next Monday. But it starts next weekend when everybody else is rounding out their regular season. Which I don't know if it's a gigantic disadvantage being well-rested, but at the same time, it comes with a potential third game against St. Mary's, which you would think would definitely happen, just given that league isn't very good.
And I mean, who's the only other team who's in the top 100? Isn't it BYU?
Yeah, and they beat BYU like pretty easily the first time they played them. And like BYU just got crushed by St. Mary's, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, but that's the problem for the West Coast League at this point, is that they have 2 outstanding teams that are excellent year after year. And if BYU has a down year, they only have 2 teams.
Even then, if like St. Mary's stumbles in the non-conference at all, like they're just out of the tournament. Like even now, like St. Mary's like a phenomenal record. And like they're like a 6th seed or a 7th seed on the good old bracket matrix. Even though they've only lost to 2 teams. But like they played garbage the whole entire non-conference. Besides playing Dayton and Stanford. But Stanford sucks, so that doesn't really do anything for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's Gonzaga, St. Mary's, and then BYU, San Fran, and Santa Clara are all essentially equal at this point.
So, like, they would be number one on my list, too. Then, like, after that, I don't even know. I'd, like, pick which one you think would hurt the least. Like, Villanova, like, incredibly efficient. Like, they play slower. So, like, maybe you wouldn't get, like, run out of the gym by Villanova. But there's still a good chance you would get beat by, like, 10 or 15 points. they beat everybody by 10 or 15 points. Kansas and North Carolina have like a ton of talent.
Kansas and North Carolina, like, I think North Carolina is way better than, considerably better than Kansas, even though the record doesn't necessarily reflect that. Kansas is good, but this isn't like a vintage Kansas team. Like, they're going to win the Big 12 because they always win the Big 12. They'll get a high seed in the tournament because they always get a high seed in the tournament. But I think this team is strangely vulnerable to a team that plays like Mick wants to play. I think they would struggle to defend the interior bigs, and they would also struggle to score when the game is, you know, a grinded out rock fest. Like, that's not the type of game that they want to play or excel at playing. Do you really want Frank Mason III to, like, just start throwing rocks at people? It's not really his game. He's good when he can get out and go.
He's shooting 50% from three this year.
Yeah. But can he do it with a rock throwing at his head, you know? Tough question. See, but like, that's the problem with the Big 12, is that everybody tries to beat Kansas doing Kansas. Like, it's the same problem with everybody in the SEC hiring Nick Saban's disciples. It's like, you can't out-Bama Bama. You can't out-Kansas Kansas. Like, you have to come at it from a different angle, but it seems like everybody in those leagues tries to replicate them, which has its obvious flaws.
Going a little further down, like some of these two seeds, if they ended up as one, like obviously if Baylor somehow ended up a one seed, you'd definitely want to be in their region. Like, it doesn't matter how good they are. Like, I would take my chances.
You just really don't trust Scott Drew, do you? I mean, look, you have ample reason not to trust Scott Drew.
Like, they're another one of those teams. Like, they played their best ball in December, I think.
Yeah, like, the team from the top eight as currently constructed that I really, like, on paper, everybody would be like, yeah, I like that matchup. If they got matched up with Oregon, hard pass. Just hard pass. They have a 7-footer who shoots 40% from three and, like, leads the nation in blocks. So that's going to be an interesting problem for UC to solve. They also have Dylan Brooks, who reminds me a lot of Bembry from last year, which, as you might recall, UC could not guard him, even a little bit. So, no 6'8 guys who can do everything. Like, can I get those off the schedule?
That would be a pleasant relief. Like, I think...
I still see that afro and have nightmares. Just bouncing majestically. Terrifying.
One day when we're really depressed, we'll like talk about the worst tournament losses. I think that one definitely be near the top of the list for a number of reasons, like how they could have tied the game, except he didn't dunk it in like a tenth of a second. It's like the most brutal way, I think. That was almost worse than the West Virginia bank shot.
Almost. Yeah, because you can handle losing on a lucky shot. You cannot handle losing because you didn't lay it in. Because you went strong. Oh, God, let's stop.
Awesome. It's like they just focus on sad Octavius Ellis.
Hey, we made one shining moment, again, in a negative capacity, again. Like, you can make a one shining moment video of UC players crying.
Oh, man.
Like, you might have to loop some of the clips, but you could do it.
Yeah, you definitely could. You could probably just do the whole post-game of the UCLA loss. Deflect that morgue. And like sad Justin Jackson.
I thought we were not going to do this. Let's move to positive stuff.
The positive would definitely be that, like, UC could definitely make the Sweet 16. And they could definitely give any of these one seeds a tough game. So if you look at the rest of these fives, like we'll just use the five seeds. Like Virginia, Cincinnati, Wisconsin, Creighton. If you ask like most of these one seeds and two seeds, who they wouldn't want to play, like Cincinnati would rank like right at the top, I think. Especially with how they've been playing lately. And like you can take advantage of Wisconsin and Virginia, at least the way they're playing right now. And Creighton like is missing like one of their best players.
Which, as an aside, is kind of spectacular what Creighton's done without Foster. I thought they would crater completely, like our neighbors to the north have done with their injuries. But they're continuing to play outstanding basketball. It's really, really impressive to watch.
Creighton, near the top of my teams that are fun to watch list. I'll watch it. I'll give Creighton a random watch. Like, they played on Sunday. I actually watched their average. Actually, I didn't watch it live. I just recorded it. But a fun team. That plays really fast is always.
Well, that's exactly what I was gonna say. Like any team that doesn't do what UC does, I want to watch that. I will not willingly watch a Wisconsin or a Xavier game unless I have some rooting interest. Like I watched the Northwestern Wisconsin game just because I wanted to see Northwestern break this ridiculous curse they've had for so fucking long. Like it is the year of curse breaking in Chicago. Let me tell you.
Really, it's kind of something. I thought kind of there is a part of me that wants them to like completely collapse amidst the tournament.
You are a sick, sick man. Can't they have nice things?
They can. They can. I at least want them to sweat it out Selection Sunday.
Now you're just being a dick.
Yeah, that was one of the most.
Look, I'm a Cavs fan. Well, what you just asked for was like several layers below the decision, but it's still pretty bad. It's like, hey, Northwestern, you've had all this pain in your history. You know what? I want you guys to fuck up just enough that you have to think about it on Sunday. Just enough. That's mean, man. I mean, I didn't light my jersey on fire, but it was a sad day.
Yeah, I should apologize to Northwestern.
I should. Yeah.
You just got
a lot of people in newsrooms across the country nodding. It's like, yeah, damn right. Damn right.
Bob, is there anything else you want to hit on before we wrap up this edition of the podcast?
Nah. No. Good.
Yeah, I don't have anything else to add either. So, beat Memphis, go Bearcats.